Run the money printer. Make it go burr. Let's do it. Is MMT real?
Okay, welcome back, everybody. It is Sparky Abraham here. I am the finance editor of Current Affairs. I'm here with my good friend Pete Davis.
Hello, everyone. Episode 2.
You have decided to come back to us. Thank you so much. We're amazing. So happy to have you. You know, it's a little shocking, honestly, but I'm really glad it happened. So welcome. Hello. Thank you. We are here for our second installment. And just like Pete said on the first installment, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to learn, and we're also trying to work together on this and think through and have questions and get those questions answered.
About what questions, Sparky?
Oh, well, we actually, if you all go back to the first episode, there were a whole lot of questions that we talked about at the end of the first episode. And we're gonna
the giant big question.
Oh, you want me to say the title of the thing. Is MMT real? This is our question. Is MMT real?
Is MMT real?
Is it real? Is it true? Is it new? Is it useful? These are our questions, and we're going to have just a million sub-questions. So before we get into the sub-questions, Pete, can you tell the listeners who our guest is going to be in a few minutes here?
Okay, our guest today is Pavlina Cherneva. She is an associate professor of economics at Bard College. She's in the pantheon of current MMT folks, and her specialty, this is like, it's like in a heist when they're taking the bank. Some people work on like weapons locks and keys.
Yeah, yeah.
Other people hack into the computer system.
Right.
If Kelton is George Clooney in Ocean's 11, Pavlina Cherneva, her expertise is the jobs guarantee. So that's what she's carved out. And she is the probably leading expert out there on the jobs guarantee, which to MMTers is like one of the major policy proposals that, according to them, comes out of their kind of ideas about modern monetary theory.
Okay, wait, I just have to bring up something completely unrelated to MMT because you mentioned Ocean's 11.
Yes, no, please do.
Someone pointed out recently that, like, I think it was either Ocean's 11 or one of the sequels is one of a very small set of movies where the actor playing one of the characters in the movie exists as themselves in the movie's universe.
Yes.
In addition to the character that they're playing.
Julia Roberts, right?
Julia Roberts is mentioned in the movie as an actress, even though she is playing a character in the movie.
It's incredibly strange. Early 2000s was the time we had the most experimentation with like kind of things that would be amazing to a 17-year-old guy, which is what I roughly was.
Right.
It's like, okay. Wow.
Like, whoa.
Have you seen Memento? And I hope like in the 2040s we cycle back to stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. I've wondered if
it's a movie where every scene is different, and you know, Being John Malkovich had that too, kind of.
Oh, Being John, that's true. I mean, yeah, yeah. the whole Charlie Kaufman
yeah, all of that,
scene.
Yes.
Was, anyway, back to the jobs guarantee.
This is the first ever intro of Pavlina Cherneva that starts with a long digression on Ocean's 11, where I compared her to the person who like knows how to, you know, rappel down the building or something.
So, you know, the idea of this is before we start talking to our guest, we want to talk about the questions that we have left over from our last guest and some of the things that we want to try to get answers to, more clarification on in the coming interview.
And the answer to that question is we have questions about everything.
We have questions about everything. And we're going to have questions about even more because we didn't really talk to Professor Kelton very much at all about the jobs guarantee. I think it might have come up here and there. But, you know, I expect that we are going to get a whole lot of new information to chew on while we try to get our lingering questions answered. But, you know, keeping that in mind, what were we left with last time?
Well, we were left with, you know, how does inflation work? What is the national debt?
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter if people are savers or spenders?
Mm.
Is there any use to a wealth tax? How far can MMT go in kind of giving money to states or around the world?
Mm-hmm.
What is a bondholder?
Is there a, you know, what does it mean that there's a market for money? a supply of dollars? Is that a different thing domestically than it is internationally?
And you know, the thing that I think touched on the jobs guarantee, Kelton mentioned the jobs guarantee, but we're going to like really talk about the jobs guarantee today. The thing is, they always talked about real resources and underutilized real resources. So like the big MMT thing seems to be to us so far. We know nothing though. That's one of the themes of the show. By the end, we'll know it all. But MMT is really big on you can keep spending if the real resources are not being used. And the reason they're really into the jobs guarantee, I think, is because an unemployed person is a real resource not being used.
Yeah. And Professor Kelton said something in the last episode that we didn't talk about at the end of the last episode, but that has kind of stuck in my head. And it also was kind of brought up in Raul Carrillo's recent article in Current Affairs about MMT, which is that she said that unemployment is a policy choice, that we keep a reserve of unemployed people on purpose for some economic reason, and that that is a bad choice. And I think that that is what that is the fact that the jobs guarantee is kind of aimed at. But I want to know what that means. I don't understand what it means to say, like, we're keeping a reserve of unemployed people. How are we doing that? Why would we do that? What is happening? What is the orthodox thinking there such that the heterodox thinking is, no, we should give everyone a job?
Yeah, is it like unemployment is an unfortunate problem that we need to solve as opposed to just a choice we could flip a switch and make happen?
Right.
An underutilized resource, like according to Matt Brunig, frequent critic of the jobs guarantee, might be just like a mom or dad deciding to stay home or someone deciding to have more leisure time or, you know, a kid deciding to not work till later and have fun in their early 20s or something.
There's a question as to how we've defined what actually is a job, what is a resource, what is value in the economy.
Yes. And that I want to really ask her about that, because so on a like human dignity level, like we're getting into like you are an underutilized resource or you're fine just the way you are. You know?
Right.
And then on an environmentalist level, I bet environmentalists would say, you know, that river is an underutilized resource, or it's a thing that just should stay a river and not be used to like lower inflation. Yeah, what does this mean when we say underutilized resource?
Right. The river is a great example because, like, you know, the first notion of conservation in terms of water conservation was making sure that no water was left in the riverbed. We had to use it all. I'm hopeful that we're going to talk to Matt Brunig later to get his perspective also on some of this. But I do want to, like, just based on essentially what I've seen on Twitter, I think that, like, one of his main critiques of the job guarantee that I think we need to ask about is whether it's workfare. You know, this is something that he constantly says. Jobs guarantee is just workfare. It's welfare with a work requirement. Where we've decided that we're okay giving people money as long as they go to work. Which, you know, kind of has a very ugly history in terms of passing the United States welfare reform in the 1990s that introduced these work requirements that ended up like creating a lot of misery and kicking a lot of people off of public benefits who really needed them. I don't necessarily quite know what this means, but I think we need to get into it a little bit here and try to find out, you know, what's right about this and what's wrong about it.
And I'm sure Professor Cherneva has been in these fights before, and she's got some thoughts on this.
Yes.
And it's, like, interesting because it plays up against UBI, which I think, you know, one option is the government takes its money and just gives it to you. The other is it takes its money and makes jobs, and its money is something that maybe MMTers would question because there's not a finite amount of money.
Right. And one of the big questions that we started with, which I'm really expecting that we'll be able to get at least some clarity on, is like, I still don't understand, you know, why is it that MMT people love the jobs guarantee and hate UBI, and that people who hate the jobs guarantee and love UBI hate MMT? What is that? What are the actual relationships between these things?
So should we dive in?
Yeah, let's jump right in.
Let's bring Professor Cherneva in to the Is MMT Real studio. Hello. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad to have you here. You just wrote this book called The Case for a Job Guarantee. But before we jump into the content of your book, we'd love to ask you about your personal history of coming to this cause. What is the story for our listeners of how you got turned on to MMT and specifically how you got turned on to the jobs guarantee within it?
Yeah, thanks. As an undergraduate, I was fortunate enough to have some professors who opened my eyes to different traditions within economics. And so I think it's just from day one, I was asking questions and looking at different perspectives. But I was fortunate in my junior year to get an internship with somebody that your listeners may know called Warren Mosler, who had some ideas of his own and was looking for a researcher to see if there was any merit to his ideas. My task was to see, well, whether there's any literature that might be supportive. There were very provocative ideas about money, how government spends, what we could do with the public budget. And then I basically did some critical study of his work, but it turned out that it actually fits very neatly within several traditions within economics, but didn't quite, they didn't quite put the message the way Warren did. And so that launched the research project. I was mostly interested in big picture macro questions. How do we stabilize the economy? Mostly interested in this paradox that we are taught in economics that somehow policymakers have to choose between unemployment and inflation. And it seemed to me that there was definitely a better alternative than keeping mass unemployment. So I came at this as a macroeconomist, but eventually began researching the practical aspect, the human, if you will, aspect to job creation. And here we are.
I know we want to ask a little bit about the history of the jobs guarantee too, but just something you said hit on a question that we had, which is you said this idea that you have to choose between unemployment and inflation. Can you say a little bit more about what that idea is or was? Like, how does that work? Why do people think that you have to choose between unemployment and inflation?
Yeah, there's a concept in economics called the natural rate of unemployment. And the idea behind it is that there is some level that the market mechanism will produce of jobless, number of jobless people. And it's natural, presumably, because we can't create any more jobs. And if policymakers attempt to bring the unemployment rate lower than this so-called natural rate, we might have to put up with higher prices. The idea being that there might be too much income generated in the economy, there might be too much spending that's generated in the economy, that might push prices up. But also, if there is a shortage of unemployed workers, workers might actually start asking for higher wages. They might be able to bargain a little bit more. And that might push wages up and then consequently prices for firms to cover those costs. So you see, the paradigm is that we need to maintain, if you will, a reserve army of labor, of the unemployed, to be able to tame prices. And that just did not sound like, even on the face of it, like a good way to run an economy, and that there really should be alternatives that allow us to stabilize prices without inflicting mass unemployment and all the social costs that come with it on the economy. And maybe I should say, you know, unemployment is privileged with this very unique position. You know, economists don't really talk about other social problems as natural. Like, we don't talk about like the natural rate of homelessness. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't talk about the natural rate of hunger, that somehow if we just allow more people to have homes or, you know, feed themselves, that will just unleash all sorts of terrible things on the economy. But for unemployment, that's the conversation.
Right. Interesting.
One further follow-up question, and then we'll jump into kind of this solution that you've been promoting, which is a job guarantee. Economists like to talk about this trade-off between unemployment and inflation. But some people on the left actually want there to be wage inflation. They don't want there to be general inflation, but one of the reasons they want there to be full employment is that wages then start going up. If everything starts going up, then the wages get eaten by higher prices. But is the goal to stabilize wages, or is the goal to just have wages go up, but not other prices go up? And we're obviously revealing our hand as laymen, non-economists here. So could you help unpack that question a little bit for us?
Yes, that's an important question. So there are two parts to this story. First, we all want wages to rise. We all want the floor to be lifted up, that it is firm above poverty wage floor. And we know what this economy has done. Almost half of American workers earn less than $15 an hour. There are millions that don't even earn that. And others that don't even have a job, so they earn zero. So we want to raise the floor. We want to firm up what constitutes a basic, decent wage level that's uncompromising. And anyone, wherever they work, public, private sector, can earn it. Now, the second bit is about stabilization. We know that the economy has a heartbeat. We know that the economy expands, contracts, and we want to be able to produce an environment that is generally stable without periodically in mass laying off workers. Okay, so what the job guarantee proposal we can discuss does is actually provide a stabilizing mechanism that's a substitute for unemployment. So number one, it raises the wage floor by providing a basic job option to anyone who wants it. And also it matches this heartbeat of the economy. When there are people that are laid off en masse, it actually provides the employment opportunities. But when the private sector recovers and starts growing and provides more employment opportunities, better paid wages, then the program shrinks as people move to better opportunities. So we're looking for a structural change that provides good incomes and a stepping stone to better employment opportunities within a full employment environment that is all around better for the unemployed, for unions, for private sector, for the public sector, you name it.
I mean, I think that you've described sort of how this looks and what the structure is in what you've said so far, but can you just say a little bit more, like what is the jobs guarantee? You know, what does it look like?
So maybe it's useful to start with this question. Do we believe that if somebody walks into the unemployment office or is looking for work, they should be able to find it? Is this like a basic proposition that we can all agree on? And I think it's probably sensible that, yeah, if somebody wants to work, they should have employment opportunities. They shouldn't be going into this environment that's kind of cruel, you know, trying to outcompete the next unemployed person for the scarce jobs that are out there. Okay, now, what should that environment look like? Well, of course, we want good jobs. We want the private sector, the economy to create strong, robust, better paid employment opportunities with good work conditions. But we are noticing that it doesn't. Increasingly, it doesn't. There are jobless recoveries, and the jobs that are created are precarious. So what if we put in place just a public option that just constitutes the basic job offer as just the minimum that one can find in the labor market? And let that be the floor, the standard for all jobs in the economy in terms of basic pay and benefit package. Think of this as a public option. You go into the unemployment office, you look for work. We try all the conventional ways to find you work befitting your skills. But if absolutely you cannot find exactly what you want, we will create a menu of options in the public service sector to fulfill some much needed public service work. Now, it turns out that this program will benefit precisely the people who have the hardest obstacles to entering the labor market or holding on to good jobs. Those who juggle 2-3 part-time jobs because we cannot find one stable employment opportunity. Those who have the greatest obstacles to employment because the private sector considers them undesirable, unemployable for one way or another. And it is a basic guarantee that one key aspect of economic security will be provided to all. So I think of the job guarantee very much the way I think of, for example, public schools. You know, we think as a society that young people should have guaranteed education, so we guarantee it. If as a society we think that we should have an environment where everybody can find work and we should guarantee a basic, decent job offer, then that's the job guarantee.
So trying to drill down on this a little bit, like you say that it would be a guarantee of a job that would fit someone's skills or kind of what they're coming in with. So like, what is that? You know, okay, so like I'm an attorney, right? Like right now I work in legal services. If I were to lose my job and then I were to go to the unemployment office because I can't find another attorney job or in a recession, whatever, like are they going to try to get me an attorney job? Am I going to be kind of cleaning up the park? Does it depend on what sort of my community needs at that point? Or does it depend on something about me? How does this kind of play out? What does it look like for people?
Yes, this is a design question. And the question is, what kind of jobs will we create and for whom? Now, the principal mechanism for job creation is that it creates some community work that is needed and fits the job to the person in the sense of their skill and need, but it's still a basic job offer for macroeconomic reasons. It provides the basic wage benefit package. So if you are an attorney and you would like to do some work with community organizations, some legal work that it may be in short supply, they may not be able to afford them, and you would like to participate in these areas, then that program, the public service employment program, will provide it. Now, you can really expand the definition of the kind of work that you can do, because there are all sorts of folks that might lose their jobs. And of course, if you're an engineer at NASA, this might not be terribly satisfactory, right? That this is a basic job offer with, let's say, $35,000, $40,000 wage benefit package, and you might seek other employment opportunities. The way the economy works is that the high-skilled individuals don't tend to experience the scourge of unemployment. They don't experience unemployment for very long. And if they do, they tend to have the assets and the income to weather a short spell of unemployment. But really, it's the bottom that we are trying to firm up, the foundation of the labor market, and provide a mechanism that really formalizes, strengthens the labor market, and provides better work experience for those at the very bottom. So, you know, folks who might have not completed high school, folks who are regularly last hired, first fired, folks who have difficulty holding on to certain private sector jobs. For example, people with disabilities would like to work, but the market doesn't quite create, you know, jobs fitted for people with disabilities. In fact, our law allows us to pay as little as $1 an hour for a person with disability. So what we want to be able to do is provide a suitable job for anyone who comes in. And so if your particular conditions require you not to stand for very long hours, if you have a particular skill like a web skill, a technical skill, or would like to do some of the upskilling with our program, then that's the program that will be available to you.
You know, this sounds kind of, for someone who's never heard of a job guarantee before, it sounds very out there, but I'd like to talk about maybe two examples that normalize it a bit. So one, you know, just on, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. So one is, I see this on a very small level a lot. So you have these kind of community groups like churches, and there's a member of the congregation who they're having trouble holding up a job, or people who are not chronically having trouble holding up a job, but they're in hard times. And you sometimes see if the church has enough money, they'll be like, hey, do you want to be the accountant for the church for a year? Or do you want to be the person that cleans up? We'll pay you for it. And the goal is not really that the church exactly needed that job at the time, but it would be useful, and it serves this purpose of helping keep this congregant employed. And you see this with some civic groups too. And even, you know, in towns and small towns, sometimes the city will hire someone because they'll take one for the team of being like, oh yeah, we'll hire them, we'll keep them going. And this seems like that on a national level. The other normalization I've seen of this is this was pitched in the civil rights movement. And in the 60s, there was a whole kind of push for this. It was part of the civil rights package at the March on Washington. A March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was the long name for it. So I'd love to hear about whether that first example is something that people kind of have used as a metaphor before, and also talk about the civil rights history of it. You know, some of these ways we see a jobs guarantee in national culture already.
Yes, I think you're right. The guarantee is what scares people. Like when they hear job guarantee, they're like, oh, wait a minute, what are you talking about? You know, why are we guaranteeing jobs? By guarantee, I just mean that there's a program that's there that you can tap into on as needed basis. Okay. And the second thing I think we want to think about is the current environment guarantees mass unemployment. Like this is really the problem we're trying to deal with. We're trying to find a way to reduce that drastically, to provide a stepping stone transition employment opportunity for people who need it, and to reduce all of the social and economic costs of unemployment. We can talk about that, but it is an extremely expensive proposition from an economic and social point of view to maintain people in mass poverty and joblessness. Okay, now, are these not real jobs is one question. Well, the answer is no. They're quite real. That we have a public sector that's responsible for dealing with, you know, social problems. And we also see that there is so much public sector work that is kind of neglected. And it might seem small and insignificant, but actually it makes a huge difference. You know, I'm reading that in New York City, trash is not being picked up because, you know, because budgets are being decimated through the crisis. And it seems like a simple thing, but it's a public health concern. Sanitation is a public health concern. Tree planting might seem like a simple, you know, and maybe like a fake job. But you know what? We recognize that tree planting is vital infrastructure, especially for urban and polluted areas. Those are the lungs of the city. So, you know, we could talk about how many things we can do if we just put these two problems together. One, that the unemployed need work. Two, the public sector does need to fill in a whole bunch of gaps. And so we are creating jobs for the public purpose. So it's a bit of a different model, indeed. But also the job component was recognized as a basic human right. So even before the civil rights era, you can think of the UN Declaration of Human Rights that codified the right to work. And many modern constitutions actually have the right to employment in the constitutions, but the mandate is not met. You can think also of FDR's second Bill of Rights, the economic Bill of Rights that's begun with the right to a job. And I think that, you know, this is a very important point that in a market economy, in a, one of the primary ways in which we provision for ourselves is through wage paid work, not the only one, but it is one important mechanism. And it is a basic right for somebody to have access to paid employment. So during the civil rights era, that conversation was revived, that you could think began in the 30s and 40s. We understood the intersection of unemployment with other social and economic injustices like racial subjugation, that unemployment was in full employment was very important to the African-American community. And that was taken up by Martin Luther King as a signature piece. And, you know, we keep having this conversation. You know, right now, the job guarantee was now embraced by the Green Movement and was put in the Green New Deal. So we keep coming back to this idea that it's not just jobs, that it is a precondition for so much of what we try to do, whether it is racial justice, whether it is gender issues and equity issues in the labor market, whether it is the transition from fossil fuel jobs and providing some safety to folks who might lose their employment as we move to a green future. I mean, everything is connected to everything. And unemployment seems to be kind of at the heart of these problems.
When you talk to people who are into modern monetary theory, or when you kind of read about modern monetary theory, jobs guarantee is something that frequently comes up. And I guess in the way that you've described it so far, I could see someone thinking this is a great idea, even if they're not necessarily an adherent or even don't know anything about modern monetary theory. What are the connections here? Like, how is MMT and the jobs guarantee connected, and why are they so often joined in the conversation?
Yes, clearly the job guarantee predates MMT. You know, people have arrived at this conclusion that we need to guarantee this basic human right. I think what MMT has done is it has taken a different research program and tried to explain how public finances work, how the government budget works, and dispel a whole lot of myths about these artificial constraints that, you know, somehow the public sector doesn't have financial resources and we need to tighten our belts and we just can't afford, whether it is economic rights or anything else of public value. So MMT talks about money and specifically state money and the public purse. Apart from breaking down that shackle that the public sector has, in a technical sense, unlimited funding capacity to pay for its priorities, to finance its budget deficits and debts. MMT also has another kind of contribution to our conversation, that if you issue a currency, you also have a responsibility to provide it in a manner that is consistent with public objectives, that is consistent with economic stability, and it's consistent with specifically full employment and price stability. So going back to the start of our conversation, the current model uses unemployment to stabilize the economy, right? Now, if the public sector is in charge of macroeconomic stabilizations, and if the public sector can appropriate budgets to to that end, then let those budgets be linked directly to providing a base wage in the economy through a full employment program. That provides important anchors for the labor market, for prices, and an automatic stabilizer that did not previously exist. So in some sense, they are inherently connected because the government has the ultimate power of spending and the ultimate responsibility for providing economic security.
One thing I've seen as a connection to MMT is that, so MMT says don't focus on the deficit. This is a very quick summary, and you know way better than we do, but from what we understand, MMT says focus on inflation, don't focus on the deficit and debt. And one of the reasons I've heard that MMT is interested in the jobs guarantee is because if you have unutilized real resources, including unemployed people in terms of resources, you can activate those resources through kind of public payment without having a lot of inflationary pressure because they were underutilized before and now they're being utilized. Is that a correct kind of summary also of a connection here? Is that there is less inflationary pressure from a jobs guarantee than there is from, say, a UBI where you just send people money without asking them to do anything?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are many reasons why the job guarantee is less inflationary, but there are two things. The first thing is that let's compare the job guarantee to current policy. What do? We, you know, imagine an enlightened government, and that enlightened government says, okay, we're just going to achieve full employment by all means possible, and we're going to prime the pump, and we're going to send contracts anywhere and everywhere and provide subsidies and tax cuts and all of the conventional things that we do. And we dump a lot of money into the economy. Now that we can use for sure. There's a lot of work that has to be done. But if we try to stimulate, and usually that happens by picking winners, right? And when you try to stimulate an industry that is already at capacity, that's already highly skilled labor and folks that don't experience unemployment, and then there's bidding war in those industrial sectors for workers, skilled workers, you can see how this kind of stimulus would be more inflationary than if you just went and employed the unemployed and just provided the basic job offer and did it the opposite. Rather than hiring from the top, we hired from the bottom. What I'm saying and what I'm suggesting is that there is plenty of industrial policy that is needed and must be done, but it's not going to secure full employment because it doesn't ever trickle far down to those who need work, especially when you work through private sector agents who are, for one reason or another, find certain workers not to be suitable for their jobs, okay? And so in this sense, the public sector can just go directly to the problem by employing the unemployed, and there's plenty of public needs that need to be tapped. So by comparison, one, it raises the floor, while the other one kind of bids up wages in the top. With respect to UBI, I mean, look, you know, there are many versions of UBI, and we can spend a whole hour talking about what that is. But if you're thinking of, instead of a job, providing $30,000 income to every citizen in the country, by comparison, this kind of budget is going to dwarf multiple times over what the job guarantee budget will be. And if you dump it into the economy, it doesn't create additional output on its own. You also provide it to folks who don't need it. And it basically does represent a major fiscal injection that doesn't have the automatic stabilizing feature of the job guarantee. And UBI still doesn't create enough jobs for all.
Maybe this is just a difference in understanding, but like what you're saying, it sounds like when you're characterizing UBI as a $30,000, you're saying that would go to like a real universal UBI, like it would go to everybody. What if you just had, you know, a $30,000 a year unemployment benefit?
Well, I mean, it doesn't solve the unemployment problem. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. And surely, you know, we can provide income. It's not a financial, this is not a financial question. You know, the government could do it. Is the $30,000 wage to unemployment insurance, what is going to be the impact on the market? What is going to be the impact on paid employment? Is it going to provide, you know, the kind of stabilizer in terms of wages? If the government is providing a $30,000, $40,000, is that going to have a negative labor supply effect? I think these are legitimate questions. Is that going to cause, you know, a lot of people to step out of some precarious private sector work. Now, then the next question is, if those folks still need work, if they still want to find paid work, will the private sector create those job opportunities? And my contention is that no, the private sector will not. And we just need to provide work with a supplementary program. And the reason is because unemployment is important to folks for reasons greater than income. And I think this also has to be recognized. It's not just, you know, people don't work just because they're going to get income. You know, there are multiple other social, psychological, health reasons why people like to work, want to work. And so my contention is we provide those opportunities. So what I'm saying is that the job guarantee is not the substitute for other policies. And we should think carefully of how to craft a jobs program along with an income program to support folks who cannot work and shouldn't work. And there are good reasons why they should not be in the labor market or can't do it. And so I tend to talk about something called participation income. I think of the job guarantee as income provided to participate in public service and the community. And I think of it as a program that resides within a broader welfare system that supports students with, if you will, you know, free tuition, universal child allowance, robust social security, all of the other dimensions of economic insecurity that folks tend to experience.
There's a few questions here, and I do want to get to kind of this moral civic question of, like, is unemployment a problem? Like, on a civic moral level. But before we get to that, just on the economics, like, if you provide kind of very healthy unemployment benefits for people that kind of can't find private sector work, and people did start dropping out of Burger King and Subway and home healthcare jobs, you know, to take that unemployment income, benefit entitlement, whatever we want to call it, would not those jobs start saying we need to compete with unemployment income to get our workers back? So they would start raising wages to try to woo workers back. Why do we think that that would not cause there to be wage raises? So you're saying, like, oh, if you always have a $15 jobs guarantee job, that will make other people want to pay $15 to win workers back. But if you always have a, you know, whatever the equivalent unemployment for 2 years, 3 years, whatever length it lasts, wouldn't that also cause the same thing to happen?
There will be some effect like that. Yeah. You know, if you're getting an unemployment insurance that is generous, you know, $2,000 a month, and McDonald's is giving you $1,000, of course, you're not going to take the job. So yeah, I see that there will be some benefit. Now think of all the other aspects to comparing unemployment to a job. You know, a job also creates a public output. It creates some specific public good. Now, unemployment, it doesn't by definition. And unemployment also creates this odd problem of unemployability. So if McDonald's or the restaurant increase the wage as a consequence of trying to compete with unemployment insurance, they're still not going to hire the unemployed. They will still prefer to hire people who have already worked.
Yeah.
And that is what we notice in the labor market. It just works in this way that especially the long-term unemployed have the hardest obstacles. And just in the eyes of the employer, they are no good. And so while I appreciate the sentiment, and I absolutely agree that our unemployment insurance system is just, you know, broken and needs to be, you know, fortified, you still don't deal with these other aspects and other obstacles. I mean, there are just so many other ways in which employers discriminate and basically find methods of not employing workers. And so by comparison, the job guarantee by comparison with unemployment is a step up and improvement for their life chances.
I hear kind of on a practical and also these kind of non-economic, non-income parts of work, I'm sympathetic to some of those arguments about participation in the community. And also on a practical level, if you do want to go beyond kind of this minimum level of income, gives you training and having a lot on your resume for a long time, like a big gap could kind of kneecap your whole career, things like that. I think a lot of people's concerns, and I'd love to hear your response to this, are that, you know, let me tell it through this story. You know, one of the most shocking facts that kind of haunts me, and I think haunts a lot of people, is the computer revolution doubled our productivity, but yet we work more hours than we did back before the computer revolution. And I think there's this, some people use the joke like, robot communism or robot space communism or something like this. The idea, like Andrew Yang talks about this too with automation, like the idea that we could increase our productivity and technology and pay those dividends into working less hours and having less people work. And that unemployment is actually the thing we're trying to build as a society, which is a society that has grown technologically and productivity-wise to achieve all of its needs without having everyone work is the eventual end goal to some people. And the jobs guarantee, I think their fear is that it locks in this paradigm that that's not our goal. It locks in the paradigm that the goal is we're always working forever. And so I'd love to ask, you know, what do you think about that question of, let's say in the next 50 years, we triple productivity. Should we all work one third? And is there a concern that the jobs guarantee might prevent that or set us down a path of saying, oh, we should always just work up to the productivity level and just make more and more and more? What do you think about that kind of challenge?
Yes. So we should all work less. Yeah, I agree. We are overworked, overstretched. There's lots of work that's nonsense out there. We're not utilizing technology in the right way. We should automate away a whole bunch of jobs. People should not be packed in meatpacking industries. They shouldn't work dangerous environments. Absolutely. Use technology. But I really question this vision of the unemployed society. I mean, what is that vision? Is that a vision of where people don't do anything and they don't organize? If you're talking about a paradigm shift, we provision for ourselves. We care for ourselves. Everything that we do, 80% of what we do is we educate, we train ourselves, we feed ourselves, clothe ourselves. It's all services. And so the question is that going to go away with like mass unemployment? You know, wage work happens to be the coordinating mechanism of this work now, right? If you want to envision a different coordinating mechanism, sure, let's go. And we could talk about that. But in this juncture, wage work is one of the, you know, also unpaid work. We got to recognize this. But it's one important coordinating mechanism. And that work has to be done. I mean, people do have to eat. So I just cannot foresee this, you know, leisure class society where somebody will be kicking up their feet and somebody else will be feeding them. Who will that person be? And so, see, the idea is that the job guarantee could establish a job standard. And as I discuss in my book, the 30-hour working week was the popular option back in the 30s. I mean, that was like almost 100 years ago. It's long overdue. If we do a job guarantee that has reduced working hours, then that becomes the standard for pay and for working time. If the job guarantee provides universal childcare, and Medicare benefits, then that becomes the standard for all. I would much rather decouple medical benefits from jobs, but we also need mechanism to do paid leave and all the other things. So it's a structural reform. Unemployment is not a structural reform. And then if you want to think about paradigm shift, the job guarantee does offer something valuable here because it recognizes and pays underpaid and undervalued existing work. It provides employment opportunities on different bases. It is not because we are going to generate high profit from your employment. If that's the model, then employment is a cost, right? If it's a profit-driven employment paradigm, then employment is always a cost. People will always be, you know, too expensive to be hired. But if the employment is done for public use and public service, then the job guarantee kind of fills that gap. You can potentially envision a society that has, you know, transitioned into valuing better and more these activities that just need to be done by the public sector.
You've essentially been talking about this already, but I want to just kind of ask directly, because I think one of the most common criticisms that I've heard of the job guarantee is that it's basically just workfare, right? Like, we kind of have a long and ugly history of taking something that we offer as a social safety net benefit and then attaching a work requirement to it as a way to basically get people off of it, right? To do like austerity and to kind of force people back into the economy in a way that really has nothing to do with like dignity of work or anything like that. You know, how is this not work fair? What is the difference? And when you talk about providing jobs for people who, for example, are undesirable to the private employment market because of a disability or whatever, you know, right now a lot of those people would be collecting disability payments, and you know, some of them might want to work and do jobs that they're not allowed to do. Some of them might be perfectly happy kind of doing their own endeavors, you know, whether those are artistic or something else. So like, how does this sort of interact? And what would you say to people who hear you say this and think, well, you know, are you just trying to replace federal disability benefits with a work requirement?
Well, I mean, the answer is no. It's a straightforward no. This is an additional program. And I talk about it as a missing piece of the social welfare system. It's a broken system. I mean, we need to do much better on many counts. But again, the logic is the following. If you have food insecurity, we got to guarantee food. If we have education insecurity, we guarantee education. If there is retirement insecurity, we guarantee retirement. If there's job insecurity, we give you a little bit of money and then maybe train you for jobs that aren't there. Which, like, we need to have also a job option. Now, you can do a job guarantee in a bad way and a good way, right? You can certainly, you know, have a policy that is punitive. And I think that there are politicians that don't hesitate to use direct employment to those ends. So we got to be able to advance an affirmative and more democratic solution. The job guarantee as proposed is just a straightforward job in the public service sector that is proposed and designed at the local level from the ground up by folks who understand what are the needs of those communities. Now, you can do democratizing budget, you know, the participatory budgeting, other democratic models of organization. I mean, we can talk about this, but the point is that if we want to really affirm the right to employment, we want to do it in a dignified way. This is not a substitute for other benefits. That's not the job guarantee. Now, I want to go back to something that we talked about earlier, you know, like, what about unemployment insurance? What about a generous unemployment insurance? Like, we have European countries that have generous unemployment insurance and almost close to permanent unemployment insurance. They still struggle with the problem of unemployment, and they still don't have a policy that ensures that if somebody needs work, they can find it. And so in that sense, this is a kind of a missing component of the welfare safety net. Now, with respect to, you know, artistic endeavors and valuing creative work, etc., that's all part of the public purpose. I don't really see why these are formidable challenges, because we've done this before. We've seen it done in so many areas, on small scale and big scale. The New Deal, of course, understood that musicians and poets need to eat and they need some basic economic stability. We see that, you know, across the oceans in India, there is a rural employment guarantee. We see the material immediate benefits of providing directly employment for people who need work.
So public employment has played this huge part in American history. And, you know, the New Deal, a lot of it was just a very large jobs program and the Civilian Conservation Corps and things like that. I'd love to ask your thoughts on why a jobs guarantee instead of just, say, take the National Park Service budget and add 5 million jobs to it, or, you know, say, you know, every year assess the level of unemployment and just increase the amount of public jobs as job positions, not as a guarantee. And is it correct, you know, an addition to that question is the way I kind of think about it, like a very kind of way of reading the jobs guarantee as a public hiring program by the federal government is it right to think of it as a more flexible way of doing like a large increase in federal hiring? So instead of saying, let's add 5 million jobs to the National Park Service, let's say, let's add this amount of jobs and then let every community decide how they want to use those jobs in their lists of nice to haves that they have on their city kind of request sheets. I guess the first question is, why not just increase kind of the staff of the federal government? And two, is it correct to think about this as increasing the staff of the federal government, but it's just a much more flexible program? And I'd love to hear your general thoughts on that kind of constellation.
And I'm very happy you asked me this question, because there's so much confusion out there on this point. And I feel like that the job guarantee has been asked the impossible task. You know, that, you know, it has to now fix all like public sector problems that we're facing. And of course, we are living, you know, after 50 years of austerity and decimating public services and all of that. And a lot of folks like find the appeal of the job guarantee because they think, hey, you know, now we can hire a whole bunch of people. Just hire the people. Like, that would be absolutely my preference. You know, if I had, again, an enlightened government and it said, look, let's just staff the EPA, the FDA, as needed, with all the inspectors, with all of the engineers, let's do it. Let's provide a fortified fire prevention program. So these are guarantees, you see. They're guarantees that the public sector will do what it is supposed to do on a permanent basis. And so you could think of it as a service guarantee, public service guarantee. Now, slightly different from an employment guarantee, because in such a world, we will have a far more stable economy and public services, and we will have much smaller problem of unemployment to deal with. Does this mean that we still should not be guaranteeing employment to the last person on the line who has not found a job in these, in the public works department or in the private sector? No, I think that it is still a good idea to provide the public service employment. Now, then also the public sector will be far better suited at employing those folks, you know, get unemployed people to shadow some of those teachers, get them to work in the public service, National Park Service. We can absorb them much easier while we are providing the training, the credentialing, all of the other things that folks might need to transition elsewhere. So I think the answer is yes, you want to have stable, ongoing public services that are well supported. You want to have a private sector that generates good jobs, and you will still need a public option for those who are left behind.
I want to just come back to something that you said. I don't know the history here, but you said something about the New Deal understanding that poets need to eat, I think is what you said. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that, like what that was and how that fits in with the jobs guarantee. Because I think what I was kind of alluding to is I just hearing anecdotally, or rather kind of describing anecdotally, I can say that like the people who I know who are writers and want to make a living being writers, I think are big fans of something like a UBI and are very skeptical of a job guarantee where they would say like, oh, you know, what I want to do is write, and I don't necessarily want to have to like go work 30 hours a week doing something, especially if that thing feels kind of like artificially created in order to kind of like justify my being able to live and do the more artistic endeavor that I actually want. But it sounds like that's kind of a incomplete understanding of it, how that actually worked or would work.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the New Deal, we had the Federal Writers Project. That was a program that specifically employed, you know, historians, writers, teachers. There was a theater project that employed unemployed, you know, actors. The Writers Project actually did the slave narratives, the oral histories. Jazz musicians, you know, I lived for some time in Kansas City. You know, there were programs for unemployed musicians. And there was a generation of young people who were trained by those employed by the New Deal musicians. And so, you know, it's an odd idea that an artist will say it's a made up job, where the idea is precisely to bring in that work into the community, to allow others to access the output, if you will, of the creative output of those people.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're giving a more sophisticated answer than the question was, which is I think that people often imagine that the jobs guarantee is like, okay, well, you have, you know, the job is going and cleaning up the park, right? I don't think people usually conceive of it as like, at least in the sort of online imagination of being like, oh, you mean this jobs guarantee would actually pay me to do the thing that I want to do rather than the thing that someone tells me I have to do.
Yeah, I agree. It is a matter of imagination. I also would say I really am unhappy when people poo-poo the sanitation jobs and like, you know,
there are always these
examples. But I'm not saying you're doing it, but there's that narrative.
No, I was a little bit. I'm sorry. No, but you're totally right.
There, right? Like, you know, how do we talk about all those unskilled people that have nothing to contribute? Like, I mean, really, they're really not employable. I mean, there's kind of something dehumanizing about the way we talk about folks who just can't do anything that can be of use. And I just contest that. Now, I agree that there are many folks that have something to contribute of different value, whether it's artistic, whether it is, you know, some green work, some care work. And I know that there's that fear out there that, oh, I would absolutely hate to have a job guarantee worker, you know, do Meals on Wheels for my elderly grandparents. And the question is, why? Why are we horrified by this idea? Do we not have elderly problems? Do we not have folks who might need, if you will, companionship, or if somebody who can check in on them, education, somebody who could just look in on them. There is a way to train people to do this work. And some folks may be suitable and some may not be suitable. But what I'm suggesting is that if we open up the imagination of what is considered useful in society, we can help through the job guarantee to create those opportunities. Once again, I want to emphasize, I'd much rather have permanent structures that deal with this work. And so now we just have to just completely rehabilitate the idea of the public purpose and that it's the job of government to do those things.
Mm-hmm. As a final question, we're not going to end on kind of one of these hard, what do you say about this questions? Let's end on a positive note, which is, what is the state of the jobs guarantee in the United States? You're kind of probably more than anyone else out there aware of where it's picking up steam, which candidates are getting interested in it. Is there prospects for it becoming law in the coming decade? What's your ear to the ground on this, the state of this policy idea?
Well, it very quickly became mainstreamed, I think, during the political cycle when a number of Democratic presidential candidates endorsed it. And then there were a number of bills that were in the works. Some we've seen, like the experimental pilot project that Ilhan Omar had put together, but also Cory Booker had talked about. Now, what I find was very exciting is how other people who are working on other issues are finding and understanding how the job guarantee connects to their work. Like the Green New Deal, for example, using the job guarantee in a multi-pronged way within the Green Agenda, both in terms of a guarantee, in terms of the public option, the transition, the bridge program, but also a guarantee for well-paid union jobs into the industrial strategy, as well as an income guarantee for minors and others who might not be able to work and need early retirement. I also am encouraged by recent polling. We have been polling the job guarantee or the idea that the government should create jobs for the unemployed for quite some time. And it's always been upwards of 50%. But in the last few years, recent polls are showing upwards of 70% and strong bipartisan support. So it's not, you know, jobs are not like a left and right issue. I think that it resonates with many people. I'm encouraged by the fact that international organizations are paying attention and listening, and or at least trying to revive this idea of the right to employment. You know, I use the example of the movements in the early 90s that coalesced and then produced the New Deal. There's an opening and then a whole bunch of other meaningful reforms happen. I think that it's incumbent on us to just provide what people want. And if people want jobs, I think that we need to find a policy that does that. If there are folks who don't want jobs, you know, we can think about what is the kind of support that, you know, we can provide for those people. But this deals with a very particular problem. If somebody wants a job, we can guarantee a basic job option. And so to that end, I'm encouraged that the conversation is widespread, and we'll see what happens next. I think at the policy level, some sort of direct jobs program is going to happen. It almost irrespective of who's president. There will be direct employment. There will be some infrastructure. But the question is, are we going to be building walls, or are we going to be fighting fires in California and dealing with the floods and hurricanes across the nation?
Thank you so much for coming on Current Affairs and helping us get closer to the question of, is MMT real? We really appreciate it. Stay tuned, listeners, for more questions in this realm of ideas that are rising up around modern monetary theory.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We have just talked with Professor Cherneva, mostly about the jobs guarantee, a little touching on MMT. Sparky, your initial thoughts. What is your kind of takeaway?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I was surprised about that I didn't really understand in terms of the jobs guarantee is almost like that she sees it as, I think I was thinking of it as what people see as sort of a utopia or like kind of the goal project. And it seemed like she saw it much more as sort of like an incremental fix, a sort of smaller step in the right direction in terms of having kind of like the problem of unemployment, the problem of like shitty social safety net, the problem of like less worker power as kind of a step in this direction, as opposed to kind of like the correct end state, which I found a little bit more palatable, I think.
I'm totally with you on that. I was actually, my big takeaway as I was thinking was jobs guarantee as the vision of the future is like, I'm totally with Brunig. It's like, why are we locking in the unemployment is bad paradigm? But jobs guarantee is pragmatic way to address the fact that we still live under a kind of a system of wage labor with kind of spotty other public things. Maybe it's kind of a very reasonable thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say, right? And it's hard to say without kind of getting into the specifics, because I think that, like, you know, she said there's a bad way to do it and a good way to do it. I think there are probably actually thousands or millions of bad ways to do it, and probably fewer good ways to do it. And I think, like, there's kind of a serious political pull and a temptation, especially toward the end where she was talking about, oh, this could be the project of either party. Well, I think that if it's the project of either party, it's...
Yeah, well, that's like, dangerous, yeah.
It's dangerous, right? There are lots of very upsetting ways that this could go.
Yeah, actually, the benefit of something being bipartisan actually could ruin the policy of it. You know, if you allow, oh, we're going to get it passed because of its bipartisan nature, instead of getting it passed as just like another program. If it was pitched in a totally different direction, it wouldn't raise any red flags. So, like, I kept thinking, like, okay, let's imagine there's city unemployment offices or neighborhood unemployment offices.
Mm-hmm.
And people go to those neighborhood unemployment offices and they're like, I want a job and I'll do anything. I just want a job. And then the city's like, oh, we'd love you to plant trees, but we don't have the money in our budget to plant trees. And now there's a federal grants program where if you ever find a way to kill two birds with one stone, which is that you have a nice to have on a local level that's not a need to have because you're not putting it in your budget anyway. It's just a nice to have. And you have a person who wants to do it. We will put that together as a grant program from the federal government.
Yeah.
And if you call it that, I'm like, oh, that sounds like a very reasonable thing. It could be called the federal nice to have grant program. And it's like, if you could kill two birds with one stone of a nice to have and employing someone, we'll give you some federal money. That doesn't trigger you're getting rid of our slowly cutting back wage labor utopia. It just triggers we're going to get some more local things done and kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
Kind of positive hopes.
That's an interesting framing, but that kind of raises the question for me of like, okay, well, if you were going to do that, why even kind of like link it to this sort of jobs guarantee framework? Why not just have a federal grant for local governments so that they can pay people to do their nice to haves? You know, like, why would you link it to unemployment as a problem?
Yeah, because, well, I think Professor Cherneva would say, if you do a bunch of grants for your nice to haves, which is what the federal government already does with a lot of things, like, oh, you want to build a highway, you want to help fight racial equity, you want to felt this, there's like a rain of federal money for different nice to haves. And the whole reason they have federal money for it is local communities want to do this, but they're not putting it in anyway. But then they hire someone for those gigs that are kind of in the middle of the employment spectrum. They don't hire unemployed people. So, but then I imagine there are some programs like this, like if you hire a formerly incarcerated person, we will subsidize that wage. I bet there's some state or that sounds like something that would have a state or federal program behind it or something.
Well, I mean, I think like this kind of gets me back to the incrementalism point, because I think that like one of the things that you don't want to do is you don't want to make it like everyone has a right to have a boss. Right?
It's like, yeah.
Oh, you don't currently have a boss? Don't worry, we'll give you a boss.
Well, yeah, I see things on both sides of this. So on that side, rich people all over, including people who are like upper middle class, like if you have a certain amount of income and you're part of a certain amount of like flexible career cultures, as much of the professional class is, like set your own hours, weave in and out. Oh, don't worry if you took 2 years off with your kids, come back. You know, that's still a fight too, of course. But you usually take retained earnings and buy freedom with it. Either freedom from the economy. I want to, you know, spend the next year with my kid. He's only six once. Or freedom in the economy. I want to go start a startup or work in a nonprofit, or I'll go work at Current Affairs. They're not able to pay me as much as I could get somewhere else, but I'll go work there because it'll give me more freedom. So that is available to the top third of the income bracket in the United States right now. A lot of flexibility and freedom through income, not through like a job guarantee.
Right.
And part of the goal, I think what Brunig will probably say when we interview him, is the goal of it is not leisure of sitting around everywhere you want. It's the leisure of spending time with your kids, volunteering at church, cleaning up the park for fun, but you don't have to go every day, you know, and, you know, doing your art or whatever. And so,
Like if I want to plant trees, if I'm getting like a solid UBI, I can go, I can go plant trees, like if I want to. A big part of the question is sort of who your boss is and how much power do they have over you. Right. And like right now, you know, basically, like if you could make the jobs guarantee boss, whoever that is, you know, in a sense, it's kind of like a boss structure, because you have sort of like the local bureaucracy, that's going to be operating, and then they're going to be operating in compliance with whatever the federal requirements are. You know, you kind of have, as you often do with the government, like a lot of bosses. But as long as that structure is better than what private employers are generally doing, I could see how that would create pressure on private employers to basically be better bosses, to allow people more freedom if the alternative is more freedom, even if it's not sort of like total freedom. It's not rich person freedom, but if it's better than working for Uber, then like...
That's interesting. Yeah, that's like a really concrete way. Like, was it fun to work for the Civilian Conservation Corps? Maybe it was.
Maybe it was.
Know. Sometimes yeah, maybe it felt like a great thing. You know, maybe these jobs are great.
Yeah. Sometimes it probably sucks.
Yeah, I don't know. So it gets into these questions, you know, when she opens up the thing that it's not just about money, it's about freedom or meaning or purpose, participation, things like that. We got to kind of open the hood and ask, is it providing that? Maybe it is. Maybe it's not.
Right. And that stuff, that stuff just gets really complicated too. I don't know. I have feelings about this just because like I have members of my family who I think have gotten sort of trapped in the disability depression cycle, right? Where I think like, you know, one of my potentially more kind of conservative views is that actually, you know, having a thing that you have to do, having some structure is really helpful for a lot of people. I think that in that structurelessness can be really harmful. Just in that, like, I've seen, you know, it's very easy to fall into a trap of, like, if you don't have anywhere that you have to be, then if you are depressed anyway, or if you start to be depressed, then you just kind of, like, stew in it, degrade. Like, it's very easy to fall into a really, really harmful pattern. But on the other hand, like, that's the argument that people make to do workfare.
Well, this is the hard thing. I think people, this is what, like, what is at the heart of all these debates? We got to figure it out. It's like... I think the thing that the Brunig side of the world, the jobs, I'm using him as a stand in for the jobs guarantee critics who think it's workfare.
We'll see what he actually says. But
well, when wealthy people have kids who are stuck in the depression disability cycle, but the money is not coming from the government, it's coming from their kind of trust fund.
Right.
They can find structure. It's just within a structure of more meaning. You know, their parents sit them down and say, you should get into a hobby or something, or don't you want some money to start a business or whatever. And that gets them out of it, as opposed to you must work or you will starve or something like.
And that's definitely true, because I think that like, I'm not even sure that happens as much to sort of rich people, because so much of the depression trap is a trap about money.
Yes.
And not feeling like you can do anything and feeling like you're sort of so laser focused, tunnel visioned on like exactly what your problems are, which are like, how am I going to make the bills this month?
That's very true. You know, it could be that that's not the case. To give a fair hearing to the other side, is it a form of dehumanization to tell a person like, oh, you have no interest in those moral and civic goods of employment participation?
Well, I mean, I think, and this is where like, you know, I just keep coming back to this. Like, there are a lot of different ways to do the job guarantee, right? Like, I don't necessarily think that I want to work that much. I mean, I think that, like, if I had an option, I don't know. It's a hard question.
Like,
I think
right
that, like,
now, we're recording a podcast that we're not paid for, so.
That's true. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, this is exactly the thing, right? Like, and, you know, I guess I now have taken payment for maybe an article that I wrote for Current Affairs, but like I usually like do that for free too. Like I don't get paid to do the editing or anything.
Is that a case for or against the jobs guarantee? So
I don't know. This is what I'm trying to figure out.
It's like we want to work against. Honestly, it's because we are economically secure from some other part of our life. For both of ours, it's like another job that allows us to do this for fun. And I actually, you know, would be like, you know, I wouldn't want to, when I get to the point, you know, I'd like to, you know, have to be concerned about the income generation a little less so I could do more things like this. And is that what the kind of Brunig UBI Yang world will get? Or is this the type of thing that shows I want to work and we want to attach people to the economy?
Right. And I think it's kind of, it's a utopia versus pragmatism thing to some extent, right? Because I think like my utopia would be my work is divorced from my, you know, life security, basically, right? Like I can eat, I can be housed no matter what I'm doing. And then I just get to choose what I want to do completely separate from that stuff, which is not, it's definitely not the jobs guarantee, I think, is a little bit more rooted. And this is what Pavlina said. Like we are in this system right now where we kind of run a lot of our economy and a lot of our society through the employment system. And so like the jobs guarantee works with and through that system. That's not necessarily the best way to run a society, but that's what we're doing right now. And so that's kind of where this idea is aimed.
Yes.
I think a UBI kind of imagines a different society.
And if you go all the way to the utopia of the UBI, and I really do think this is like what Brunig tries to get at with like the social wealth fund. Mm-hmm. That's basically a way to like formalize the idea that as the economy grows, it pays a dividend to everyone and slowly increases their income and wealth, which I assume many will cash in to decrease their time spent in undesired employment. Mm-hmm. In the dream where you go all the way to all the wealth is created by the robots, Pavlina is right. You still need to be served at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. If the experience of the restaurant is being served, you still need someone to play in the theater performance. Like it's not sure. going to all be automated. You still need someone to cut your hair. And those need to be someone. And so there has to be some system of deciding how production is done. And I do think there is a claim that you cannot just have employment be decided based on who wants to work at yeah. all or not.
Right. Or who wants to do very, everybody might want to do, you know, the distribution would not actually be right to run a society if everybody was doing what they wanted to do as opposed to.
Yeah, that like someone needs to staff different things and we have to have a mechanism to do that. I don't think the mechanism should be if you were born into wealth or if you used monopoly profits to like never have to do anything and control everything. That is not a way we like as lefties, but it has to be something. And so you can't totally write off that jobs have to be performed.
Yeah, and I think the reason why we still need to kind of like think through these utopian questions, right? Like what we want it to ultimately look like is, I think of Oren when I think of this, because I know Oren has made this point on the podcast before, though I know that it goes back to other people. But it's like, you know, I think we need to know if something like the jobs guarantee is, even if it would improve things in the near term, is it creating a structure which will then be harder to get rid of if it's not ultimately the structure that we want, right?
Yes.
Like, is the jobs guarantee strengthening the links between the obligation to work and the idea of work and employment and having a boss and being able to access the necessities of life?
Yes. And I think where we're at, tell me if you disagree, where yeah. I'm at right now is if I could see the future and the jobs guarantee helps like end the immiseration of unemployment for this like 5-10% that are really suffering under that, especially people like formerly incarcerated people who really are desiring jobs but don't have them because of like barriers. But it never is used as an argument to not expand the welfare state and entitlements. That's fine. If it solves things in the short term
yeah.
and it cripples our ability to fight for a UBI or other such fights, might not be worth it. I don't know. And I think that might be at the heart of these debates on the jobs guarantee.
Yeah. I mean, that seems right. We're still talking about the jobs guarantee. We did not talk to Pavlina as much as I would have liked because we didn't have enough time about sort of the structure of MMT.
Yes. Okay. That's how I wanted to end our convo, which is I thought the whole argument was going to be it lowers inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Or UBI causes inflation, jobs guarantee does not. And they don't seem to be arguing that anymore.
Well, yeah, she doesn't at least. She didn't, I mean, she emphasized that very little. I think that she said that a little bit. But, you know, and I think this is a point that Matt Brunig has made that we should talk to him about too. And it's a point that you had kind of made in our notes, which is like, you know, that's a sort of harder argument to make that like the jobs guarantee is a complete inflation control, because that would mean that all of the jobs have to be adding the full value of exactly how much money you're putting into them. And that just seems unrealistic, right?
Yeah, I guess I understand how if you have a car sitting in a lot hidden from the world and you bring the car out to the lot, that lowers inflation because you've increased the supply of a real resource and someone is demanding that car and they get the car. Money didn't go up. Real resources went up. I assume that the reason the jobs guarantee is connected to MMT is because they think unemployed people are underutilized real resources. Mm-hmm. But the question is, it doesn't work as much like when we provide a thing that's not being demanded by the market, like a public good. Let me think up one. Like, oh yeah, building Yosemite, you know, like mm-hmm. cleaning up Yosemite, which is currently paid for by someone.
Sure.
Does that lower inflation? Because where's the demand that Yosemite is cleaned up metaphysically? Right. Or does that increase inflation because that money was paid to that guy and he goes to Walmart and puts inflation pressure on buying stuff?
I think metaphysically is an interesting word that you've used here, right? Because I think that thinking about things in this way kind of requires an economic value view of more of life than maybe I'm inclined to put in those terms.
Yes. But yeah, so maybe I should say metaphysically, I should say, does it, if you cleaned up Yosemite 100 times, you know, like let's say you clean it up every hour, full scale army of people cleaning up Yosemite, the trails, every minute you have the Tokyo subway cleaners run through it. At what point does that cause inflationary pressure?
Right.
And if we all as a society really wanted that, like we all just suddenly felt that it was really important that the trails were clean at all times, does that lower inflation pressure? So it's not even metaphysical, like spiritually, what do we want to be as a people? It's literally, does it cause the value of a dollar to go up or down?
Right. Right. Who are we going to talk to who's going to explain this to us?
If you are listening right now, listener, and you have an answer to the Yosemite Tokyo subway cleaner desiring of the trail question, does it cause inflation or not? I'd like to know. Because I thought the jobs guarantee was about inflation. It doesn't seem to be, but I think that is why it is tied to MMT. It's not just that this one subculture decided as a completely separate matter to get into this one policy area. So we have to figure that out. Sparky, before we go, is MMT real? What do you think, we're closer to the answer? Where are we in the detective journey?
I think because we didn't manage to get into these very basic and probably stupid structural questions that we have, I don't feel any closer to knowing whether MMT is real. I feel like I have a better understanding of what the jobs guarantee could be, about what problems it sort of addresses or could address, about what its possible failings are. And I think that she gave us a nice situating of the historical push for a right to jobs with the kind of current understanding of modern monetary theory, right? Like, it makes sense why those two would be allies in her description. But I don't think we got sort of the intricate links that allowed me to feel like I understand MMT any better.
Yes, I think I'm with you there.
And I mean, and I think in terms of our three questions, right, which is like, is it true? Is it new? Is it useful? We got a little bit of an idea of, if you think the jobs guarantee is useful, then adopting the MMT framework is useful. I think there's still questions about whether the jobs guarantee is good. And I don't think that tells us a whole lot about whether MMT is true. It sort of assumes MMT is true.
Yes. I think we've placed more chess pieces on the table.
Yeah.
Without kind of taking them off, which is expected of the second episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to make a mess before you clean things up.
Yeah, continuing my Lost metaphor, in the second episode of Lost, there were more mysteries added than answered. We're only going to start really turning the ship of answering Maybe. Things later Maybe. In the detective series. Maybe.
We'll see.
Until next time, I think our next episode, we're probably going to bring on some MMT critics.
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
Yeah,
for that,
I think that's the plan. Maybe they can give us a little bit more structural information, even if that information is anti-MMT, but we can take that as ammunition to our next MMT proponent and kind of get our back and forth volley going, which is the big idea here.
The sleuthing continues.
This podcast is a badminton game.
Yes. Yeah, no, how many metaphors are we so far?
Okay. Thanks, Pete. This is fun.
Thank you.
Listeners, we will see you all later.